If you're ready to elevate your level of care and professional satisfaction, register today for the Trusted DPC event that can help get you where you want to go. With three physician-led tracks focusing on starting a DPC practice, growing a DPC practice, and clinical expertise within a DPC practice, the Direct Primary Care Summit has content for anyone, no matter where you are in your DPC journey. The DPC Summit is happening June 20th to 23rd in Dallas, Texas. Learn more and register today at dpcsummit.org. Today's episode is a re-release of Dr. Nitin Gupta's story, a pioneer in pediatric DPC. Last year at about this time, I had the pleasure and honor to meet Dr. Gupta in person while I attended the inaugural Pediatric DPC Mastermind. You'll hear me ask some impromptu attendees about their experience at last year's event before today's interview, and after listening, you'll most likely have a sense of FOMO if you haven't already registered for this year's Pediatric DPC Mastermind. Check out the episode I recorded with Dr. Deanna Berry a couple of episodes ago, talking all about what's coming at this year's Pediatric DPC Mastermind. Registration is open until January 31st, so check out pediatricdpcmastermind.com or check out the link in the show notes. Also, use the code MyDPCStory at checkout and get some amazing exclusive Pediatric DPC swag when you check in. Enjoy! So now I'm here with Dr. Rachel Coleman from Honeybee Pediatrics in Florida at Splitsville in Florida as well. What was your favorite thing about the mastermind, given that you helped organize the very first Pediatric DPC Mastermind?
Well, I think I would say my favorite lecture to this point was the lifestyle medicine lecture. I just love the way she had it organized so straightforward as those pillars of lifestyle medicine, and it inspired me to look up the details of getting certified in lifestyle medicine, and I think I'm going to do it.
Fantastic. And in terms of people who were not able to make it this year, for next year's Pediatric DPC Mastermind, who is this mastermind for?
This mastermind is for anybody on the spectrum of DPC. If you're DPC curious, if you've just opened, if you're established, you can learn so much, and it's just like the best group of people you could ever hang out with in your life.
Love it. Thank you so much. So I am here with the culprit of this whole event, this whole successful, amazing event that has inspired already the people I've interviewed are proof that this is going to blow up, as it should. So Dr. Deanna Berry of Berry Pediatrics, for your encore presence on the podcast, can you tell us what you have seen with the people showing up, with the event going on, with the speaker speaking, with the sponsor sponsoring? What have you been able to see from this amazing grassroots movement that has caught on like wildfire?
Thank you. You're so sweet. So it's been a really great weekend already. We have one more day, so I hope everything goes well tomorrow too. But in general, I'd say this was more than I could have imagined it would be, and it has nothing to do with me. It has to do with everyone's energy. Everyone came so open-minded. It's been a lot of fun, but also really heavy on helpful information. I am excited that we'll have more. There's no way we're not going to do this again. It's just a matter of what it'll look like. And I can't wait for you to be there right alongside me. This has been so much fun to be able to meet you and spend time with you.
It's funny because it's like we talked when you did your recording for the Pediatric DPC Mastermind preview. But yeah, like one of the things I love to represent that is like when I talk with people and then see them in person like we are right now, it's like I already know people. It's like we're family because we're all tied by DPC.
I couldn't agree more, and I've said to so many people here that I feel like I am with my tribe. That I know it's corny to say, but I feel like I know you all, even though we just physically met this weekend in person. Which kind of blows my mind. And when you already have that foundation, so many things in common, you have that trust because we've all helped each other through hard things. You don't have to start at the basics of a relationship. You take off as soon as you're back to physically together. And I told my husband that I feel like I'm with all of my high school best girlfriends when we all get together over, you know, a vacation or holidays or whatever. I just feel very comfortable with everyone here. Everyone here has been so gracious, but also just very eager to help one another. And I mean, you just can't help but feel that it's genuine. And I think that people who have not started are feeling very supported.
Absolutely.
They really feel like we are going to journey with you, alongside you as you start. And I cannot wait a year from now when we do the next one, when some of those people will already have been in practice and open, and maybe they'll be speaking to the next group, you know? We all pay it forward to some extent. And even if you think you're not qualified, well, there's definitely someone who can learn from you, because there's someone who's less prepared and less ready than you. I don't feel like I can speak to this. I've only been open 2 years, but there's someone who's been open less than me, or is not yet open, who could benefit from what I have to say. So it's very much a team building, inspirational cheerleader, like a lot of just the warm fuzzies.
It's been awesome.
Love it. And so, can you fill in this blank? If you are blank, you need to come to the next Pediatric DPC Mastermind.
Ooh. If you are, oh my gosh, where do I start? If you are eager for a change, if you are feeling unsettled, if you are looking for more, if you are wanting a bigger, to make a bigger difference, if you are feeling unfulfilled, all the reasons that you're thinking about leaving your current fee-for-service practice, we all were there or are there right now, and we're here, and we're leaving feeling much more capable, confident, ready, excited to go that next step and actually go from talking about it to, and I hope tomorrow we talk about how to make some of these things actionable, and actually follow through. And so we're going to do, about the closing, we're going to do some SMART goals, like the acronym SMART, so that people actually can go home and do something, make the change. Even if it's one small baby step, that's how we start, right?
Absolutely. And like you said, it's a baby step because these are our babies. And so I love that you guys have come to create this, that this has blown up like crazy. This has inspired and will continue to inspire people. And you heard it straight from Dr. Berry's mouth. Next year there will be another Peds DPC Mastermind. Thank you.
There is no way there won't be. Honestly, this has brought so many of us so much joy that it has to happen again. And I'm hoping more and more people will come. There's plenty of everything to go around. There's no limit to all the information, the encouragement, you know, that we could give everybody. So yeah, the more the merrier.
So don't have FOMO. Get your tickets as soon as the dates release, people. So we are going to do a round table because this table is just exuding DPC excitement. So I'm going to start passing the mic around. So if you could please share with the audience your name, where you are in the DPC ecosystem, and what have you loved about this inaugural Pediatric DPC Mastermind?
Oh, straight to me. I'm Dr. Nitha Gupta from Rivertown's Pediatrics in New York, where I am in the evolutionary.
Are you wearing your fanny pack?
No, I'm wearing my branded T-shirt. I guess I'm quote unquote the Godfather, and ever expanding our practice. Best thing about this was finally getting to meet the doctors that I guess mentored over the past 4 or 5 years now. So,
amazing.
Who can I pass it on?
Hello, I'm Drew Hertz from Zest Pediatric Network, based in Cleveland, Ohio. It has been an incredible event, surpassed everybody's expectations. I have been amazed by the enthusiasm for the movement, and equally amazed by the various reasons that people are excited about this, and the various reasons people, or the various ways people are approaching creating their practices. It's just been enlightening, and I love that we're creating something very specific in pediatrics, and that we are differentiating ourselves in this space.
Hi, my name is Lauren Don. I'm from Dawn Creative Group. We're a boutique marketing agency, and we're proud to be allies for all DPC practices. We're lucky enough to help Dr. Nitin Gupta from Rivertown's Pediatrics to start his practice, 4 or 5 years ago, and just to see the amount of growth and the amount of impact he's had within his community and actually expand across the country and see how many other DPC practices opening on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. I'm just completely blown away and thankful to be part of this community. So thank you so much for including us.
Hi, I'm Regine Briochet. I am a pediatrician in Brooklyn, New York. I'm at the beginning stages of my DPC journey, and honestly, the best part of this experience, being part of this pediatric DPC mastermind, was the connections that I've made with folks who are just recently started. Some of the veterans have been in the game for 2+ years. So I'm hoping to take all the information that they've provided and to really take off with my practice later this year. So look out.
So now I'm joined by Dr. Roland Gutierrez. And one thing that I would like to point out first is, can you share your worst day in fee-for-service with the audience who wasn't able to attend this year's mastermind?
My worst day in fee-for-service, I saw 80 patients. 80 patients. I was by myself. It was not medicine, but I practiced. It was unconscionable. It was inexcusable. And after that, I thought, no more. No more.
And for those in the audience who totally understand how barbaric that is, how did it come to the fact that you were seeing 80 in one day? What happened to the other doctors in your clinic?
Well, I showed up to work, but my coworkers didn't. So that day, I had to work 12 solid hours with no lunch and a three-month-old coded in the clinic. So I had to resuscitate a newborn in the midst of all of this. So it was terrible. It was terrible.
That is, again, barbaric. I'm so glad you were there, because that if that baby had not been able to see you, I don't even want to think about what could have happened. But balancing that, it's so sad that there's probably audience members who are absolutely relating to your story. How did you find out about the PEDS DPC Mastermind?
Well, I had known about the DPC movement, and I saw a Facebook group about it. And I said, you know, let me check this out. I saw that it completely bypassed the middleman. Instead of working for insurance companies, I was working for my patients. And I didn't have to spend all my time in administrative jobs, you know, doing paperwork. I could actually see my patients and build into their lives.
Awesome. And so far, what has been your favorite part of the PEDS DPC Mastermind?
Oh, seeing that I'm not alone. Seeing that other people doing what I'm doing with their own different slant and flavor. And I could be me. And I could ensure that I'm having my needs met, but also meet the needs of my patients, their families, and my community.
Love it. Thank you so much. I'm also joined by your wife and partner in this journey. So, Lisette Torres, what is your favorite part so far about being here with your husband as you guys dream DPC together?
Well, I really found all the information invaluable for progressing in our practice. It's very practical, all about systems, all the things that we really need right now to scale and to grow and to meet our patients' needs. So it's exciting.
Love it. And one thing that I love is, because you guys are here together, you guys have had the discussions before coming here about, you know, what's possibly your biggest fear about DPC, and what have you come in here fearing and have learned something to overcome your fear with while at the DPC Mastermind?
I think the biggest fear we have had is just not being able to know what the next steps were. And and to feel kind of alone in the process, but to hear how others have gone through the process and scaled their practice and met the need and identified, you know, what their target market is and what their niche is in terms of what they're wanting to provide for their patients is exciting, and to know that we can just do the same. And I love also that everybody's being very collaborative in reaching their patients and reaching what they need. So they're sharing their knowledge, which is, I think, just ideal.
Love it. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
So now I'm here with Dr. Marina Capella, who is in Salt Lake City and who also presented at the very first Pediatric DPC Mastermind. And what is your favorite thing that you've experienced at this year's Mastermind?
I have loved the energy of this group. I feel like it's such such an environment that invites authenticity and people to feel comfortable and open and collaborative. I've loved the diversity of people represented here. People that I don't think would necessarily have an audience in other organizations or would really get speaking roles at other conferences, but they have just been brilliant, and I really have loved the energy of the whole group.
Love it. And from your talk today, which was about how to screen for autism, could you give the audience who wasn't able to attend some high-level tips as to how to get involved if they wish to start screening kids with the time they have in their DPC practices for autism?
Sure. So first of all, there's a huge shortage of people who are doing autism evaluations in communities across the country, and general pediatricians are well poised to be able to do that and to fill a need in their communities. It's not that hard. It just takes a little bit of extra education and training that you can do in a matter of a few weeks. And if you feel at all called or interested in doing that, please do, because you will be helping so many families.
Love it. Thank you so much.
Check out the episode I recorded with Dr. Deanna Berry a couple of episodes ago, talking all about what's coming at this year's Pediatric DPC Mastermind. Registration is open until January 31st, so check out pediatricdpcmastermind.com or check out the link in the show notes. Also, use the code MyDPCStory at checkout and get some amazing exclusive Pediatric DPC swag when you check in. A note about today's episode. There is some language that may be inappropriate for young listeners, so please consider this as you listen today. Thanks for tuning in. Direct primary care is an innovative, alternative path to insurance-driven healthcare. Typically, a patient pays their doctor a low monthly membership and, in return, builds a lasting relationship with their doctor and has their doctor available at their fingertips. Welcome to the My DPC Story podcast, where each week you will hear the ever so relatable stories shared by physicians who have chosen to practice medicine in their individual communities through the direct primary care model. I'm your host, Marielle Conception, family physician, DPC owner, and former fee-for-service doctor. I hope you enjoy today's episode and come away feeling inspired about the future of patient care, direct primary care.
Direct primary care is the way medicine is supposed to be practiced. I am Dr. Nitin Gupta of Rivertown's Pediatrics, and this is my DPC story.
Dr. Nitin Gupta, MD, FAAP, is a board-certified general pediatrician who has a passion for delivering the best possible care for all children he cares for. After earning a bachelor's degree in nutritional sciences, physiology, and metabolism from the University of California at Berkeley, he graduated from St. George's University School of Medicine and completed his residency in pediatrics at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, New Jersey Medical School. He also trained at Weill Cornell Medical College in pediatric gastroenterology and nutrition. Dr. Gupta's adventurous career spans from working in the inner cities of New York and New Jersey to the far reaches of rural Maine. He has spent years working in the emergency department at the Brooklyn Hospital Center and urgent care at PM Pediatrics. He enjoys teaching and even filmed a pilot episode for a medical talk show. Originally from California, Dr. Gupta and his wife moved to Dobbs Ferry with their two young children, where they enjoy taking advantage of the great outdoors. In his free time, Dr. Gupta can be found hiking the trails of Westchester County, walking his dog through town, or paddleboarding on the Hudson River. Dr. Gupta is also an active member of Rivertown's Rotary, whose motto is Service Above Self. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Gupta.
Thank you for having me.
This is such a treat. Oh my goodness. So just for the audience to know, we've been texting this morning, you know, a few hours before, but it's like, I was up at 6 a.m. reading Carr's book with Mike Carr's.
Yeah, you know, I was like, wondering why you were, because I'm on the East Coast and, and I got a text from you at 8 a.m. actually. Yeah. And I was like, what is she doing?
That was when my two-year-old woke up, and then an hour later was when he wanted to read about Radiator Springs. So I am ready. I'm so ready for an adult conversation. This is so good. So I got the pleasure of meeting you recently at the Pediatric DPC Mastermind, the very first one, and I'm so looking forward to another one. But, you know, I think that it is so interesting. One of the things I found most interesting was that at that Pediatric DPC Mastermind, there was still, you can do peds in DPC? Like, that's amazing. And so you've been open years and years and years already. And, you know, you're up there telling your story and looking around the audience, as is common at conferences about DPC, we still see people's chins on the table, like completely gaping mouths, like, this is real. This is not a magic unicorn piece of like style of medicine. So with that thread that, like, you are not a unicorn, you are a real person. Yes. Can you bring us back to what was your life like as you were choosing to become a pediatrician before Rivertown's Pediatrics opened?
Oh, okay. So the backstory. The origin story is, many of us pediatricians, you know, we're all fans of like comic books, or at least the people I surround myself with. Okay, so the backstory, you know what, I come from a, you know, an immigrant family from India. My dad was a generational engineer. So basically his dad was an engineer, all of his brothers were engineers, and dad before that were engineers. So naturally he came over to the US to, you know, as an engineer in 1970. As you know, we talked, I was actually born and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. My dad was an earthquake and structural engineer. So of course, California is, you know, where we settled. When I was 6 years old, my dad had a heart attack. And so that kind of, I think right there was kind of my moment where I questioned my dad's mortality. I realized my dad was mortal. And that's something six-year-olds don't necessarily understand. You know, so that was a tough experience for me, but that was probably that moment where I realized I'm going down the path of becoming a doctor, much to my father's dismay.
So, you just ruined that generational line there, man.
I did. You know, I was supposed to be an engineer. And my dad had a really good point. He was like, why would you want to be a doctor? You're going to spend all these years going to school, all these years going to medical school, then training, and then you're not going to start your life, according to him, that generation of Indians, you don't start your life until you get married, you know, and have kids. So he was like, you're not going to be able to start your life or have kids until you're in your 30s. And well, I guess he was right. I guess like my first real paycheck really didn't come until like I was like 32, I think, as an attending. There are many times where I thought, damn, why didn't I listen to him? But, you know, I knew I was going to be a doctor. I really got into nutrition because that was a major thing. My dad was a diabetic and he had a heart attack. He was only 35 when he had his heart attack. So nutrition was a major factor in his disease control, but also in our lifestyle at home. So that's knowing that, that we actually at that time, and I don't know if things have changed, but nutrition education in medical school was only, I think, 2 weeks long. That was the case for me in my medical school. So knowing that, I studied nutrition, physiology and metabolism at UC Berkeley. That was my undergrad. And then from there, and I was a pre-med right from the start, knowing I was going to go down that path. People always question me at that time, saying like, how's nutrition going to help you as a doctor?
It's amazing. Like, really? It's just amazing now. Now with what we know now, you know, that's
now
crazy.
People are realizing. Yeah. I guess that maybe as I guess that kind of tells you how old I am, I guess. But I mean, that was only like, what, 20 years ago? Wait, 30 years ago when I declared I was going to go into nutrition and apply that. But now, you know, people understand. That's good. It wasn't until medical school that I realized I was going to go into pediatrics. And I've always been a kid at heart. And, you know, my first rotation in as a third year was internal medicine. And, I didn't like it. Not that I didn't like the medicine part. I didn't like the culture of internal medicine. There didn't seem to be the kind of care that I thought physicians should have. Now, I don't know if it was because physicians were burnt out already at that time, but you know, amongst the nurses, the physicians, there was always already a level of care that I just didn't think was right. And when I say care, I'm not talking about like putting in orders and, you know, getting vitals and all that. I'm just talking about like human care, like for the, and that's the thing. It was just like, I just didn't see that. And then my next rotation was surgery and, Now, listen, there are very fine internists out there and surgeons out there. But in that environment I was at, I mean, this was just a different beast of people. And maybe that was the medical culture at that time. I don't know. But my third rotation was pediatrics. And that's where I knew I was home. You know, all of the attendings, the residents, the nurses, all the staff, they all did 110% of what they needed to do for those kids. And I think that definitely reflects in medicine in general. You know, if you look at kind of the morbidities and mortality of diseases, our kids, sure, it's easy to say like kids don't get as sick. And sure, that can be, sure, I'll give you that. But let's also not forget that pediatricians also bust their butt off to make sure that that kid is not going to die, be harmed. You know, we are the masters of preventative medicine. That's our domain here. So that's how I got into pediatrics. And I think until my graduation day of medical school, my dad was like, you know, there's still time.
It just makes me think of when I was talking with Dr. Katie Liu, how, you know, she comes from an Asian background and I'm Filipino. Mm-hmm. And with you being Indian, it's just like, you know, I feel this is very cultural. Like I can absolutely empathize with the subtle, you know, passive aggressiveness of our parents sometimes. Oh my goodness.
Well, what's funny is like, there's like almost like, I guess with my dad's generation, a tribalism of like, we're the engineers. And you know what? The people who became doctors were the ones who couldn't do math. So it was like a slap in the face. I brought shame to the whole family. But if you look on like every doctor in media, like TV, like there's at least three different Dr. Guptas on TV. So it's like, I was like, there must be other members of our family who went into medicine. And that's beside the point. So after I graduated from UC Berkeley, I was applying to medical schools. So at that time, I think it was like maybe, I don't know, super competitive. I think it may still be. I don't know if it's still the same, but it was super competitive. So, of course, I didn't get in. So I tried to, you know, I was going to apply again the next year. I dabbled around in other things, other industries too. At one point, I worked for a bank doing home loans. That was before the run-up of 2008.
And proof that you have math skills. Great job there.
There you go. Exactly. But getting depressed and like, I'm like kind of, you know, could I make a career working at that community bank? Actually, I probably could have, but I wasn't feeling it, you know? So of course I'm getting depressed and wondering what are my options? What if I don't get into a medical school the next year? You know, cause the application process takes like, I think like a year or two. It's horrendous. Then I've met some folks who went to St. George's University of Medical School in Grenada, and they were doing very well. And, you know, they got residencies and they're great doctors. So I went. So that was it. An amazing experience. And I think having that experience really did plant that seed for this practice, Rivertown's Peds, because in that country, doctors made house calls. doctors were available. There was no such thing as like health insurance. So if a patient couldn't afford the doctor's fees, the doctor just said, don't worry, just save your money for the medicine. And I'll just go charge the rich dude I'm going to go see next. That's literally what one of my attendings told me. That's how he made a living, you know. And it was, if you think about it, that's a very socialized medicine type thing. But it was on the terms of the patients and the doctor. It wasn't dictated by somebody else. So just seeing that level of care and compassion that the doctors had in Grenada for those patients really planted that seed. And so
let me ask you though, when you talk about these home visits, how long were these home visits? Like, were the doctors pushed to see a certain number per day?
No, the doctor was his own boss. So it was basically it was the patient. If they called the office and, you know, he just went and made his rounds. And it wasn't, you know, but for them, it was basically a fee for service. And so, you know, if a patient called, then he went and saw them. If it was an elderly person, he went and saw them. If they could come to his office, you know, he asked them to come to his office. And that's how it worked. It just worked for his village and his community. And seeing that firsthand and it wasn't just in Grenada. That kind of care is provided in India too, in many countries across the globe.
Absolutely. My dad sat in the neurologist line, like outside of the neurologist's office. Yeah. And it was like, you will be seen after the person in front of you is finished seeing the doctor. There was no appointment time. So absolutely.
Yeah. But, the care was given, he wasn't rushed. And I saw that a couple of times. We also did a few rotations in the island of St. Vincent, same thing. And then we did our third and fourth year rotations in the US. So you go from something, you go from witnessing doctors who are active leaders and compassion in their community to like Brooklyn. not saying that there's no compassion in Brooklyn, but you know, the reason why, you know, I got married in the middle of medical school to my wife, she was in finance. We didn't want to be in California because she's also an Indian American. Her family's from Southern California. My family's Northern California. Just watching, and I'm sure this expands all cultures, all immigrant cultures, you know, the drama that happens after any person gets married. So we're just like, you know what? We're just going to move across the country. So that was it. That's how we ended up in New York. My wife moved her job over to New York City, and I was able to do the bulk of my rotations, actually all of my rotations in New York, in Brooklyn, New Jersey. And that's how we ended up. And of course I applied for residencies, tried to get back home to California. That didn't work. I matched at UMDNJ in Newark, an insanely incredible experience. I mean, like, it was just I think I was trained by some of the best diagnosticians in pediatrics, and, you know, the experiences, I don't know if anybody else can reproduce those experiences that I saw. It was definitely hard. It was a very hard residency, but I guess it toughened me up. Then I did a fellowship at Cornell in GI because I really, really wanted to apply my nutrition. So I thought, like, well, you know, proper nutrition will help prevent constipation, blah, blah, blah. So I did 2 years. I did 2 out of 3 years of pediatric GI fellowship. I absolutely hated it. You cannot practice pediatric nutrition. Like, that does not, there's no job opportunities for that. There was no hope in sight. It was either going to be, you know, as a general pediatric gastroenterologist, you know, it's like 95% of what you're going to see is reflux and constipation, and that's it.
Yep.
That was not for me. You really have to have a certain passion to manage constipation day in, day out. That I did not have that passion. Also, the thing was, I moonlighted in the ER because I needed an asthmatic. I needed an ear infection.
Oh my gosh.
I needed diversity in what I saw. So I guess I just knew I was just a generalist. By the time my third year of residency was up, I mean, I was actually kind of sad I was going into the fellowship. But, you know, I basically applied for that fellowship my first year of residency.
I can believe that easily. I mean, just peds fellowships in general, they are very, very hard to get into. I mean, well, I think about my roommate in college. She is one of the best surgeons and one of the best people I've ever known, roommate in medical school. And she is still applying for ped surg fellowship because the demands that are on the fellows and then the research that is needed to be able to be accepted into the fellowship that she's going for, it's quite challenging. And so
that's interesting. She's going for a ped surg fellow. The sad thing is the fact that she's going to go do a pediatric fellowship. She's going to take a massive pay cut in her compensation potential.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, we think about the people who didn't go to med school, who after undergraduate went to Genentech. In my case, like a ton of people went to Genentech, and it was like they have mortgages and homes and 401ks, and we're like, we're paying a medical school to go get education to take care of other people. And it's a lot of money when you think about it at the end of 4 years of training. And then you make, you know, you work 80 hours a week and you make $47,000, $52,000 a year. So it is a definitely dedication for, you know, and it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
Let me ask you though, when you said that you completed 2 out of your 3 years of fellowship and then left, it makes me think of, you know, Dr. Janet Naribis, who's near you.
Yeah.
She moved off of Broadway, but she was a surgeon before she left to go to family medicine. What was your experience like, you know, internally when you were like, I literally am a 2 out of 3 year fellow. Like, how can I leave? Because I think about people staying because of, you know, shame or guilt or whatever. So what was going on in your head?
So what was going on in my head was during the whole time in fellowship and even towards the end of my residency, my dad was dying. So, you know, these are the repercussions from having a heart attack at 35, you know, and diabetes for 3 decades. And so he was having multiple TIAs and got to the point where he wasn't able to walk. He had massive, terrible dementia. And so I basically left home at 18, right? Then whatever it took to get to medical school, then residency, there was basically a void in everything. I missed that much my dad's life. And then I find out my dad is dying and has only a few years to live or a few months by the time. So I was trying to go every weekend, flying back to California to go see him, help out my mom. He was getting hospitalized left and right. I was miserable in my GI fellowship because, like, look, I shouldn't have been there. I really should have been, you know, I was very satisfied. I loved general pediatrics. From day one, I realized, crap, I am not into constipation as much as I'm trying to will myself into. And so in my second year that my dad's like, why are you there? Like, you're not happy. And this was during his lucid moments. And he's like, you know, that's just extra credit. You already did your residency. Like, why aren't you practicing? And it kind of got to me and I kept remembering that. And then finally, after running out of PTO days, PTO hours, whatever, no more vacation days, no more sick days, because I kept flying back and forth. I said, you know, forget it. I'm just quitting. Like, there's just no point. Like, I probably wasn't even going to be like, would I have even practiced if I finished? Like, there was just, why not? Let me just quit. I spent basically what would have been my, you know, the next 6 months by my dad's side, and he passed away. And I have zero regrets. Then it took the next couple of months to help take care of my mom, get the family's finances in order. And from there, you know, because I did hate kind of every day working in my fellowship, I did see a lot of the ugliness of medicine in New York City. I didn't even know if I was going to even, did I even want to go back to medicine? You know, there at that time, there was a lot of hedge fund opportunities to go work for. You know, there's a lot of questions in my mind if I even wanted to continue. Just because seeing how, also the way my dad died, how my dad was dying, it was just, you see the ugliness of kind of end of life care, the limitations of kind of, you know, chronic illnesses, how the medical system kind of helps those people or doesn't help. Absolutely. And so I was disgusted by medicine in general. But the funny thing is, while I was at home, kind of with my dad in his last days and with my mom, there was this like locums company that had talked to me. And there was this hospital up in Northern Maine, in Caribou, Maine, where the CEO, they were clearly desperate. They needed help. And, this locums, my locums agent, I was like, yeah, fine. He just called me out of the blue. I was like, okay, cool. You know, I'll entertain. He's like, yeah, we can get you, you know, a position. You could work temporary all over the country. I was like, sure. I was like, that sounds good. Sent him all my stuff. And then he's like, hey, Dr. Gupta, I got a great opportunity up in Caribou, Maine. I was like, Maine? That sounds cool. That's where Stephen King's from. But I wasn't serious about it. I was like, let me just explore the idea. And I had a telephone interview with the CEO. And this was like in August of 2011. And I just kind of kept in touch with them. I said, you know, I'm not ready yet. My dad is sick. I'm not ready. And it was after my dad died. My dad died in October, October 3rd in 2011. The CEO called me October 4th. He's like, I just wanted to check in. I want to see how your dad's doing. And I was like, well, he died. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. And he was just very compassionate, sent flowers. And I was like, right there. I was like, you know what? I'm going to Northern Maine. That's how it happened.
Oh man.
Yeah. January 3rd to March 3rd. I was up in Caribou, Maine. That was like the dead of winter up there. I had never been so cold ever in my life.
It's just crazy because I think about you growing up in California and then going down to like Grenada and St. Vincent and then going to Caribou, Maine. Like you've pushed the limits with regards to, you know, what you can, temperature and practicing in all those situations, because the patients are totally different in those situations too. Like, you know,
so
I remember
I'm a student of culture. You know, I do like to explore. I like to see the different cultures. I think one thing the reason why I struggled training in New York and the New York metropolitan area was there was a lack of compassion. Now, people are going to deny it and be like, no, we're very passionate. No, we aren't. We're New Yorkers. And in training, I mean, training programs are malignant. That's what residency and some fellowships are. They're malignant. And, you know, they really should be HR nightmares. And I'm surprised there aren't more lawsuits amongst these things. But I, you know, doing all my training in New York, in the New York metropolitan area, you know, I didn't see the compassion I saw in the Caribbean. And I thought, this is how medicine is. Like, oh, you know, New York is supposed to be the mecca of everything. And it's like, oh, well, this is how medicine is. So anyways, I went up there to Caribou, Maine, and it reminded me, the compassion was there. That was the thing. The neighbors, I had this at that time, she was a 70-year-old nurse named Sandy, and she just knew the history of everybody. She knew, you know, a busy day was 12 patients a day over there. And Sandy would give me like a 30-minute briefing on every patient that was coming ahead of time and to tell me the whole history. And, you know, everybody knew each other there. There were stories of like one neighbor going into labor and there's a massive blizzard. So somebody from the hospital went in a snow sled, picked her up, brought her in. Same thing. Another snow sled went and got the OBGYN, brought them in. You know, these were just things that and this wasn't like they weren't paid to do that. They were just their
doing
passion.
It. These are
their,
yep.
These are their, this is their community, their neighbors, their family. You know, the briefing that Sandy would give me every time I saw before every patient, you know, there were subtle things like, hey, you know, this family, they have dirt floors. I was like, really? Dirt floors in this winter? She's like, yeah, they're basically, you know, she's like, yeah, they're poor. And I say, oh, how did they get here? Because they came from another, like a village, like 30 minutes away. Oh, they borrowed a friend's car and the neighbor brought them over. But what that told me was like, well, that visit that I was going to see, that was the visit. They pulled so many strings and did so much to get to that appointment. So that meant I wasn't going to talk about one single ICD-10 code or ICD-9 at that time code. I think that coding is one of those kind of led to our decrease in compassion, where we have to, every patient has to be classified as a single ICD-10 code. But I had to address everything. That's what that told me. And I didn't care if they're, and basically it didn't matter if we were getting paid for multiple ICD-10 codes. It was, we had to address everything and go into the sample closet, fill up that supplies, give it to that kid. But that's, that renewed my passion for medicine, for pediatrics.
That's awesome. And when you were in Maine just for a locums, yeah, and you said you left in March, what was, with this renewal of your passion in general peds, what drove you to find other jobs after that before Rivertown's?
It was terrible. my wife, you know, her, she wasn't going to move, right? So like her career has taken off. So I basically just kind of bounced from job to job. And again, it's a difference in culture and of the medical culture, of the patient culture. Let's also say patient culture too. So I worked right after Maine, I took a gen peds job, outpatient gen peds job in Astoria. And that area, that neighborhood was, you know, there's a lot of anti-vaxxers. There was a lot of like vaccine space, air quotes, I'm saying vaccine spacers. They're the gentle anti-vaxxers. I guess they're the ones who are like, no, we believe in vaccines, just not right now. I was like, so when? Well, never, but we believe in them. I was like, okay. I couldn't deal with that. And the doctor I worked for, he was amazing, very passionate. He started the practice like 40 years prior, but culture's changed. Ideology changed. And so he was kind of getting pushed around by the patients. I lasted 3 months in that job. I say, you know what? Screw that. Nobody cares about preventative medicine. Then you know what? I'm going to go back to the ER. And so I started working in ER again because I felt like there was no credit for like being the general pediatrician, being preventative. Let's go to the ER. Those guys get the credit. So I worked for 5 years at one of the hospitals that I did my rotations in. An amazing experience there. But, you know, towards the last 2 years, that experience, you really saw administrations kind of move in, take a heavier hand in how things were run. They stripped our ER of our nurse. They limited our access to the medications. And it was kind of like, well, you know, like what the hell? Like, how are we supposed to, you know, attend an emergency if you're taking our tools away, our support away?
Working. That was my favorite in the ER. The Pixel's not working. Yeah. I can't. Yeah.
Just overhead page the pharmacist. I was like, really? The one pharmacist for the whole hospital? He wants to overhead page and he's going to drop everything and come running down. But, you know, this was the cost cutting. Lean operations, right? This is, I'm all for capitalism. Cool. But like not in a hospital setting. It's okay to have some redundancy. It's okay to have some glut in certain areas because you have to be prepared for those emergencies that are going to come. So, it was getting harder and harder. And, I think what kind of set that off was there was a hospital a few miles away that basically got sold to private equity and it got turned into luxury condos. So the land that hospital was sitting on was worth more than the hospital itself. And guess what? The hospital I was working at, guess what? it was pretty obvious. The writing was on the wall. Now that hospital is still standing, but only parts of it are still there. But I think what happened was, I think COVID changed the game a little bit. There was going to be less kind of like that hospital was on the chopping block, but COVID kind of kept it going barely. But anyways, I lasted there for 5 years. I found my forever home up in Westchester anyways, after that, which is about anywhere from an hour and a half to 2 hour drive to work.
And with traffic, I'm assuming.
Oh, with traffic, 3 hours.
Oh my gosh. That's insane. Yeah. I'm very New York naive because I've only been to Binghamton to see the carousel and then nowhere else in New York to this day. So I appreciate LA traffic. So I can sort of picture the parking lot.
You came to my great state of New York and you went to Binghamton of all places. Like that's the only place you went to? Binghamton?
So I was 12 at the time.
Okay.
I'm 40 now, but I will tell you that my uncle refurbished a 1938 Studebaker and was in the Great Race, the Great Race. So it was a timed race between Ottawa down to Mexico City. And so Binghamton was one of the stops. That's the only reason I have been to New York. So
wait, he raced in a refurbished Studebaker?
Yeah. So he,
that's a completely different podcast. And yeah. That is an interview. That is a story that needs to be told.
it's great sharing the back seat of a van with your cousin who takes the seat laying down. And I was sitting down the entire trip down to Texas. So yeah, it's good times. But I think about this, you know, you're coming from what I keep hearing is the word compassion, and that is awesome. And I think about going back to the PEDS DPC mastermind, how, you know, a big discussion was about equity and, you know, in the AAP world, equity and pediatrics, you know, are supposed to go together. But I thought about when you were sharing your story, how the time with patients that matters, and the compassion that you have with patients that matters, not just equity, because equity is great. But then what happens if everyone has care, but the care is 2 minutes, 8 minutes, 15 minutes? Like
I'm glad we're talking about that, because this is a big equity sounds fantastic. It really does. But again, it's not realistic, and actually it probably harms. And let's talk about that, because equity sounds great on paper. However, you got a kid with multiple medical complications, a very sick kid. We currently have a few kids who are very complex. They have complex care. They have a lot of complex care coordination that needs to be done. You know, they're paralyzed from this kid's paralyzed from waist down, like lots of, you know what? Honestly, that kid does not need equal care to my son who's 7, who barely gets sick. I don't want that. I want less care for my kid, and I want to dedicate more care to this kid. So we have to talk about that. That kid needs more compassion. That kid, I mean, my son needs compassion. That's fine. I'm good. But that kid needs more care. And we shouldn't be afraid to say that.
Totally. I absolutely second that. My cousin, who in my mind, he's always 4, but he's now, I think, 24. He has Down syndrome. And so he had occupational therapy, music therapy, physical therapy. What else am I leaving out there? Speech therapy. And it was because of all of that intervention at such a young age that he's a flipping DJ. Like, he's a kid with Down syndrome who does DJ. Well, excuse me, an adult now. But, you know, I absolutely agree. Like, personalized care is what's needed. And that personalized care is not going to be like, you know, you can't have the black and white one paper, fill this out. That's your visit. That's not going to allow a child to get the care that they need, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's the compassion, community. Also, you know, needing, you know, for instance, our kid who has our most complex kid right now, the community has actually come together. There's a community organization that is actually paying for his membership with us. And that is key in this kid's care. We confuse healthcare with health insurance. We confuse health insurance with equity. We're basically putting more importance on payment than we are on care and compassion and community.
Yep.
And this is what is failing our kids. So when I first started off on this DPC journey, there was only a handful of us. This was about 5 years ago when I went on this journey. And I think from those who were doing this, they were adult docs, they're family medicine docs. All I heard was like, I don't think you'll succeed. And I was like, why? And they're like, well, kids all have insurance. I was like, but the kids don't have care. They may have somebody footing the bill, but that doesn't mean they have care. And so what I mentioned in my talk at the mastermind was what I discovered was what patients lack in this country, which actually most patients lack, is the access, the quality, and the convenience, the AQC.
It's so true. And, you know, I had been talking with Dr. Shannon Scholl, who's an adult gastroenterologist, and we were talking about, you know, being a disruptor. And then I was reading, I think it was the Harvard Business Review magazine, and they were literally defining disruptor as bringing more innovative solutions, specifically cheaper, simpler, and more accessible. Yeah. And I was like, there you go. There you go. That's how innovation has, you know, I wanted to ask you this because, like, when we think about innovation and, you know, just pulling from the fact that your wife is in a different profession and is on Wall Street, I wonder when you were in those early days, because there weren't a lot of mentors, and that's really like super irritating to me to hear, like, you know, the poo-pooing of like, I know you have a dream. That's cool. Oh, you're so, you know, like, oh, bless your heart, but that ain't going to work.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, and now, and now, you know, you've blown that fallacy out of the water. But when it came to, you know, I've done the 5 years in, you know, stint now in ER, I've done all the things what I want to do is general peds. And when you were dreaming about River Towns, coming from your wife's perspective of, you know, appreciating innovative changes in the markets and, you know, investing in things that are disruptive, you know, in that definition that I mentioned earlier, that can really change culture and change finances and change everything. I mean, now we're seeing DPC as a model that can be really taken forward to the next level by incorporating it in, you know, with employers, with state employee plans, with school districts, all of these things. But what was the discussion like when you were dreaming about River Towns with your wife because of her different perspective?
So yeah, my wife, she took a finance angle to it, where she's an analyst. So she basically, she dissects like the companies that she covers, and she can tell you where they're losing money, where, you know, what's making more money, what they should be focusing on. With me, you know, it's always been gradual conversation. It's always been constant conversations for over a decade with her about like my thoughts of how medicines run. I always chat with her. And so she always kind of kept that in mind. She realized when I was going to be like, I'm not going to take insurance because you know what? It's insurance that's fucking this up. But you know what? By the time I started this, when I left my job 5 years ago, it was hard to find an independent practice anymore. In New York, all the independent practices are being bought out, air quotes on bought out. They're not getting bought out. They're being incorporated. They're being absorbed. Basically, the big hospital groups are saying, we'll pay your overhead. There's rarely a big cash transaction. The reason why you want to join us is because we have the big insurance contracts that we made sure that they squeezed you on.
And as we're talking, you know, there's the one company out there, and people can go find this, the one company who, you know, oh, you're struggling with your clinic. We'll do all of the work for you. We're going to take I think it's like 0.5% of all of the payments that you do get, because we're going to do all of the paperwork and all the insurance, forms for you. Oh, you're still struggling. Well, then how about you take out a loan? But you can only get the loan if you use our, you know, paperwork processing service. And then, oh, if you're still failing, we'll just buy your clinic. And it happens to be, this is an insurance company. Like, patients do not have an idea. And at the same time, you know, I was reading about this. I had a patient literally drive up to, like, I mean, I love your main story. Like, I love that the neighbor drove that family to your clinic, but like, legit people will, because my clinic's across from the post office. It's like, whoa, they will U-turn into my parking lot, honk the horn and be like, no care for anybody else in the neighborhood. But hey, you know what? I got my 90-day refill for $1.42 because I use that magic insurance company. And so, you know, it is definitely like education of our culture is a huge thing. And so I love that you're sharing this story and telling it like it is from your history, because people don't get it that, like you've said, insurance is not healthcare.
Yeah. Insurance, not healthcare. So, you know, I broke it down. I was telling my wife, like, look, if I, you know, I've reached out to a couple of independent pediatricians. They told me like their reimbursement for like an ear infection is like 9.92 and 3. They're getting $32 for that. $32. Think about that. Now you're in New York, and I'll tell you my estimate at that time was, you know, if you're an insurance-based practice At that time, your operating costs were about $300 an hour per doctor. So that included, you know, your overhead. Your overhead included your MAs, your billers, your everything, all that glut. So imagine if you're getting reimbursed $32 for, like, you know, an ear infection, how many patients you got to see, right? So, but on the flip side, you know, we got so addicted to insurance. That was the only thing we knew. But, you know, you think about it, like, oh, insurance, you know, in theory, the insurance is supposed to make it a healthcare affordable. How is that affordable when we're charging like $200, $100 for a flu A test, $100 for a flu B test? That's $200 right there. You know, if somebody else is paying the bill, supposed to be paying the bill, what do? You upcharge everything. And so that's only driving up the cost. We keep driving up the cost. You know, that $40 rapid strep test that a clinic will charge, well, that strep test is $2. $20 for that UA, the UA is 80 cents.
Yeah.
So what if you just, you know, instead of the thing, what everybody's paying is thousands of dollars a year in insurance. You know, they're paying thousands of dollars a year in their deductibles. They're paying their co-pays. Well, what if you just paid the doctor directly? Get better care, get more convenience, get quality, get the access, and you pay the doctor directly. It doesn't have to be expensive. Just cut out the administrators, cut out the overhead, cut out the insurance, cut out the hospital facility fees, cut all that out, and actually just put care back between the patient and the doctor. That's it. It's really easy.
What blows my mind to this day, and will probably for the rest of my life, is that, like, you know, we will talk to people who are old enough to remember that that's how medicine used to be, period. Like, I think it was Jimmy Carter was the first president born in a hospital. Like, legit. Yeah. I mean, there's people who...
It was only 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
It was that managed care. It was like, what, 35 years ago that managed care became the status quo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
that was it.
It is so sad when you talk with doctors who were at that cusp of, you know, HMOs and managed care. It was like what the internet promised, like, you know, this utopia that has not happened. Yeah. But it's like when we think about managed care and the promise that people really believed in, like, it was coming from, wow, this can make healthcare more affordable for people. Like, that idea that people bought into, it's so sad because it was such an earnest desire. And then, you know, look what it's turned into. But it is so interesting how we've gone in such a short time, relatively, you know, like, how long was the Roman Empire, you know, in power? And then how long has the United States been, you know, in existence? And then look at our healthcare system, just within a short time, we've really gone to this place of, like, I'll only do what my insurance covers, not thinking about what does that service actually cost, or, like, what does it mean to me? Oh yeah, I forgot the fact that not only am I paying, you know, $40 for that strep test, but then I'm also paying the bill for the urgent care because I couldn't get in to my doctor to get the strep test.
Yeah. There's another thing. So I had this long conversation, a debate with, like, a medical student. He was like, well, how are you helping people? I believe in healthcare for all. And I was like, I do too. He's like, but then why aren't you taking insurance? I was like, oh, no, I don't believe in health insurance for all. He's like, they're the same thing. I said, no, they're fucking not. I wanted to go to the dean of the medical school and say, you need to educate these people.
For sure. It's just like
you're
nutrition.
Telling them that health insurance is healthcare, you're screwing them.
Well, it's just like nutrition, like how you were saying, you know, like your education, nutrition. And I will second that. Like, I had zero courses in nutrition that I recall at Creighton. And when it comes to the things that we need to be educated with, I was very jealous of my dental friends who would be like, oh yeah, like, I know about, you know, ideal patient. I know about P&L. Yeah. And I was like, where did you learn this stuff? Like, we just learned about the heart today. Like, that's like, you guys are going way beyond. And
well, so now what's important though, is I have no sympathy for physicians who say, like, I didn't learn anything about business in medical school. It's like, since when the hell did you stop learning? You're the smartest kid in your class, like in high school. Like, why did you stop? Like, so go learn it. But also the thing is, the business of what my practice does, it's really simple. Like, there's nothing complicated about it. I know what my overhead costs are. They're a hell of a lot lower than they were, than they are if I were to take insurance. And this is how many patients I need at my rates. And this is how I can turn a profit. It's like, it's really, there's no, I'm not worrying. I'm not pinching pennies waiting for a reimbursement from an insurance company. You know, like I'm not going to hold my breath for 6 months waiting for a reimbursement, only be told like, oh, we decided that was too much. We're going to pay you this much. No, I know exactly what my monthly income is every month. And I know how to hire accordingly. I know how to make my expenses accordingly. And that's it. It's really simple.
When going back to your wife and the discussions, yeah. I love that you had the discussions over 10 years. It's amazing. Like, I love the long term.
So, basically, if you try to go get a small business loan and say, I'm not going to take insurance, you're not getting a small business loan. So my wife was my loan. So basically, all I had to do is I didn't even write anything on paper. I didn't even have to present anything. I was like, Priya, here's my idea. My rent is going to cost me $3,300 a month, and I'm not going to take insurance, but I'm going to, and my malpractice at that time was like $9,000. It was like, if I were to have 400 patients at $100 a month, I'd be rich. And she's like, $480,000 a year. Your expenses are this much. She's like, yeah, that would work. That was our discussion. She's like, well, what about the testing? I was like, look, a UA is 80 cents. A strep test is $2. A flu test is $10. I was like, I just absorb it into the cost. That's just part of my monthly cost. She's like, what about the vaccines? I was like, that's going to be a little scary. So in the beginning, so I said, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to just market to like toddlers and up because they don't need as many vaccines. And then I'll figure out the vaccines later. And that was my business plan with her. And it worked. Of course, now I don't have 400 patients. And no, they're not paying $100 a month. Things have changed. Times have changed. I just, you can't, again, let's go back to equity. You know what? Those newborns are not the same price as a 14-year-old. So the newborns pay more, the 14-year-olds pay less. But on average, at this point where I am, because there is inflation, rent does go up, malpractice does go up. There was a couple of like a pandemic and some, like shipping delay. So the costs of goods have gone up. So on average, our patients on average pay $125 a month.
I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, but I thought that you could only charge $10 a month for a kid. So tell me about that. This is an ongoing discussion and debate. I'm totally being devil's advocate in here, but to those people who say like, it's $10 a month, it's $25 a month, whatever. How does your mind process that argument of the flat rate for kids, period?
Honestly, would you trust a doctor that only charged $10 a month? How good is that doctor? What kind of care is that doctor going to give? Let's just leave it right there on that. Think about it. I mean, like, that's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. You know, those same people who are charging too little are also the same people who are complaining that they're being overutilized. Well, it's like, well, because you're being overutilized because you're charging like $10 a month. You know, your patient population, the community, they need to also know that you can like pay rent and eat. So like if you're charging $10 a month, guess what? You're not getting pediatric patients. You're not. There is a thing. When you have kids, how many kids you got?
Two boys.
Do you ever go on Facebook to get like the Facebook parent groups and ask like, hey, can somebody recommend like just a so-so, it's just something that's so-so, I just only want to pay $10. Like, no, people they go onto the Facebook parent groups. They always ask for the best, like best place to get a haircut, best place to like send my kid for daycare, best place. They don't ask for like $10 a month. And now I'm not, I'm just being realistic on that. You're just not running a practice with those. You have to be realistic.
I'm glad you're talking so transparently, because it's important for other pediatricians to hear that, especially if they're considering direct primary care.
Yeah, what I don't understand are those pediatricians who are getting their advice from non-pediatricians on how to start up their practice. Like, why would you do that?
That is where it's so important that we see a PEDS DPC mastermind. We see, you know, pediatric groups, because absolutely, like, DPC is a business model. Okay, we can learn from each other general things. But when it comes to pediatricians as specialists, you mentioned in a previous interview that, like, what is the drive to go into pediatrics in your case, but primary care in general, you know, internal medicine, general family medicine, pediatrics, when look at, you know, what we do in fee-for-service, the typical thing that a medical student will see or a resident who's rotating will see is what I heard another resident call a primary care doctor, a referralologist. And so it was mind-blowing, you know, to hear that from a first-year resident who's in family medicine in California. But then hearing you talk about, like, what is the drive for people to choose pediatrics in general? Like, if we're devalued by the fee-for-service system because $32...
by the American education system, the medical education system, we're devalued by the medical system. And but that's an intentional devaluation. Look, I mean, CVS and Aetna are now a company. Optum, which is UHC, they're gobbling up hospital groups. Cigna is gobbling up hospital groups. You know, you're an idiot if you don't see that the insurance companies are taking over, right? And to them, if you're in insurance, here's how simple it is. Insurance companies make money by not paying the money you give them. That's how they make money. That's what insurance is. You're paying a company to hold on to your money. What they're going to do with that money is they're going to try to grow that with investments or whatever. You know, some would call it a Ponzi scheme. It kind of is, if you think about it. But they hold, because that money on hand for them is valuable. They can invest that. They can grow that money. That is their goal. Now, in order to continue to grow that money, they can't dispense that money. So they're going to do everything possible to not pay. So if they're buying out hospital groups, they're buying out practices, then, you know, like, you're going to be irrelevant. Generalists, primary care. Now, in medical school, the amazing thing about going to medical school in a different country is the smartest people go into primary care outside of America, because they're the ones who have to know everything. And so if you go into a specialty, you dumb yourself down into knowing everything about that one thing. My research project in PEDS GI, guess what? I was going to be the world's, like, foremost expert in pediatric gallbladder disease. Guess what? I would go bankrupt. Like, I knew everything about the gallbladder, like the pediatric gallbladder. There is no job prospects for that. But I would know a whole lot about very little. And I'm a geek. I love knowledge. I love it. So that's why I love being a journalist. I love being a jack of all trades. I just the other day, like, you know, I went and stitched up a kid, because I still keep those skills. I love being that person. I'm not a referralologist.
That's not, you know, not a real word. I'm sure Urban Dictionary might add that someday, but it's like, we all know what that means, right? So continue.
We all know that.
Continue.
My patients pay me directly to be the best damn doctor for their kid. I work for my patients. So if I were to work for an insurance company, yeah, of course I'd be referring like crazy. When I used to work for a hospital system, the mantra was, if it takes longer than 7 minutes, refer, but only refer to one of our specialists, because that counts part of your RVU. So, you know, how does that not violate Stark laws? I do not know. But again, I don't give a shit about that. I just care about me running my business and doing it well, and I'm doing it well.
Awesome.
I have a tiny little practice, and we're one of the largest. We are the largest pediatric COVID vaccine provider in the county. My little teeny tiny practice.
It's incredible. And, you know, I wouldn't even say that it's teeny tiny, because look what River Towns has, you know, developed into. I mean, just in your clinic, you have...
We just hired a new pediatrician, Dr. Mindy Gallagher.
Yep. You have Dr. Gallagher. You have Dr. Solomon, who's family practice. Yeah. I mean, you... Clearly, that, again, that poo-pooing of like that. Oh, yeah, that's such a sweet idea, but that's not gonna work. It has
well, we also have Staten Island. We have Rivertown Spat now, Dr. Vladimir Beriev. So he was my grasshopper. He was my Padawan for a while, and then he and then he opened up over there. It's something, it's not a concept that was going to be like a good luck to you. I wish you the best. It's what's absolutely necessary because this healthcare system is failing.
When we talk about your growth, I want to take a step back into the first days of Rivertowns, because before you added on physicians at Dobbs Ferry, before Staten Island opened up, when you were going from talking with your wife, getting, you know, she was your small bank loan or, you know, small business loan, and then opening, how did you then use those finances to fund your DPC and bring patients in?
Okay. So I think in the DPC world, we like to talk about how you can open up your practice on a shoestring budget. Cool. Yes, that can happen. And that's good. That's fine. But I'm going to be realistic. Look at the market you're in. I'm in New York City. I am, there is nothing shoestring budget here. I am surrounded by hospital groups that have Super Bowl commercials. I don't have a Super Bowl commercial. And what boggles me is that they have Super Bowl commercials that they say they're the best. I don't know how you have five hospitals saying they're going to only be one, but whatever, I digress. You know, for me, did some market research, polling people around. I needed an office. I needed an office. That's my showroom. I needed a home base. By having an office, by having a five-year lease that it says I'm here, I'm serious, I am going to be your pediatrician. Yes, I do house calls because you know why? Because nobody else does house calls. I marketed the hell out of that. The budgeting. Before opening up, I paid off my student loans the year before. Doing locums was a big help. Living, my wife and I, we try not to splurge too much early on. Now we do splurges, but we did everything we could to pay off our student loans. At those times when I was doing like home loans, like for that local bank, I learned a lot about loans. So that really got me in my mindset. Let me dedicate to paying off my student loans. So pay off your student loans. If you're going to go down this path, pay off your student loans. You don't need that on your mind. Save up a nest egg. Save up a nest egg that can support you for about the next 2 or 3 years, because it might take that long for your practice to take off. And what Dr. Vladimir Beriev said at the DPC Mastermind is in 5 years, half the people, or what do you say, more majority, or was it half?
I think it was majority. Yeah.
Majority of people are going to fail at 5 years. So you got to have that nest egg. You got to be prepared. And so when I first started the practice, so I started with a $100,000 budget. I'm in a big market with big names, with lots of flash. So $50,000 of my budget went to marketing. In my area, social media is the biggest form of marketing, or is the most efficient form of marketing. Everybody, parent group, there are Facebook parent groups. That's a big market for me. Now, look, I'm not targeting senior citizens who look at print ads. No, my demographic, average parent demographic, average age is 35. For parents. So they're on social media. They're on Instagram, Facebook, also Google. So we have a big Google presence, Facebook, Instagram. I no longer pay for Google ads because I don't need to. Yay. But, marketing materials, the business cards. Business cards do make a difference. I know it sounds old school, but you just drop a business card, drop a stack of them, drop brochures. That's what I did. Just went around everywhere. Pre-pandemic, of course. During the pandemic, we doubled down on the social media marketing even harder. And you also got to remember, if there is something that's working in terms of marketing, push that farther. You don't be like, hey, this post really worked, or the message of this post really worked, and then change the message. No. Keep messaging. That's your ticket right there. And then adjust as the times change. Right now, if you were following my social media, we've been targeting a lot of newborn house calls because we have a little baby boom going on right now. So guess what? I want all those newborns. So we've been doing a lot of newborn house call posts. You got to know your market in the beginning. Throughout, not just in the beginning, you got to know what your market needs. My market needed COVID testing. My market needed COVID vaccines. The big hospital systems couldn't get their act together. They couldn't do the testing. They couldn't do the vaccines, but I did. And so we did it. That's you know, you, if you're going to charge people out of pocket more than $10 a month, you got to give them something. You can't just be like, and you got to make sure, you know, you're doing it for the right reasons. Are you doing it because you need to be the doctor that you were meant to be? Then yes, go for it. If you try to go down this path because you just want a better lifestyle and make it all about you, well, you're going to fail. People read through that, you know? So you gotta make sure you're better than everybody else.
When you talk about marketing and, yes, you know, strategizing specifically for your market, given that you're amongst these hospitals that have Super Bowl commercials, like I love that so much. How did you go about developing a marketing plan to be so effective?
So I teamed up, I interviewed a lot of different local marketing companies, and I one day interviewed Lauren Dawn and told her and her team what I was going to do and what I was hoping. This is my plan. I'm not going to take insurance. And she said, you're going to start a new industry. And I was like, you know what? Let me cancel all my further interviews. You're the one. And that was it. She got me, because this is what we're doing. We're not starting an industry. We're resurrecting a former industry, but we're bringing it back into focus. And so that's what we did. Except what we did early on, we realized I tried to do the, so I was too hands-on in the beginning. Lauren would always tell me like, no, we shouldn't do it that way. So again, she's the specialist at what she does. So for the first 3 months, she's like, we should do it like this. And I was like, no, but the DPC handbook says I should do it like this. So I talked about like how you don't need insurance. And these are the benefits of me versus an insurance-based practice. And I talked about all the different types of finance and money and how you're going to save money. And Lauren's like, okay, I'll give you 3 months. And guess what? We went nowhere. And then after 3 months, I'm like, oh my God, Lauren. She's like, okay, so can I work now? And I was like, yeah. So we took down our rates on our website, because she has these little widgets on the website that show you how much time people spend on what part of the page. People clicked out right there on the pricing page. She took that down. And then she made it all about me and what I offer, my expertise, and then made it about the patient, what you need, made it about your kids, like about the kids. That's what it was. And it was basically the marketing went back to the patient and the doctor. That's what it is. That's what parents want. And the difference between the marketing between the Super Bowl commercial hospitals is they always say only at New York Presbyterian, only at Montefiore, only at Northwell, but they never specified as the doctors. And there's a reason for that. Why? Because doctors leave, you know, because they're just a number. For us, it's the marketing is about the, is, you know, when we market it, we specifically say Dr. Gupta, Dr. Gallagher, and we keep it about you as well. So messaging, it's important. You have to introduce people to who you are and the relationship.
So let me ask you there, because, you know, locally, it is extremely hard to see somebody who, to see anybody of physician or non-physician provider who sees kids in our area. And so really common in our area is, I'm going to go and get Blueberry Pediatrics. That's the local, you know, the local draw. So when you talk about—
That's the telehealth.
Telehealth, yeah. And it's so interesting because, you know, the commercials that I see, Facebook, Instagram, like it's definitely heavy social media. But as you talk about you guys marketing yourselves versus how these hospitals are marketing, like the system, I see like Blueberry Pediatrics is the example here where it's Blueberry Pediatrics, the name of the company versus the doctors. Are you finding, because you guys are growing, adding physicians, there's a need that keeps being met by your clinic? Why do you think people are preferring you guys as you're marketing yourselves versus something where it's marketing a company, but it's still accessible, you know, affordable virtual care?
Parents want a doctor. That's it. They want a doctor to see their kid. They don't want a device. They don't want a hospital system. They don't want a clinic. They want a doctor that they can trust. Blueberry Pediatrics, they're fitting a role. right? So a lot of what we do is a lot of what they do. I feel like I want to say we've been doing it first, but I never really investigated how long, because, you know, we send a lot of our families the Bluetooth otoscopes, and we do a lot of video health, televideo. We do a lot of pictures. We do a lot of video, but, you know, those are fine. Like we got a fungal diaper rash. Yeah. We can just get a picture on that, or, you know, but like, you know, I can't take a strep test through a video. if you got a Bluetooth otoscope, you know, it's like some of our families are very savvy with it and they could do it, but the majority can't. So, also, you know, there's also, I think we're not going to go down that. We're just not, we're not going to do, there are some devices that can record the heart sounds, lung sounds. We're not going to go down that, because if a kid is struggling to breathe, like we want our hands on them. you know, if we get a listen, you know, from a recording, we don't know if that's the right upper lung. We don't know where that is. So, but what I think is important for us is I intended to be the hometown doc, the small town doc. That's what we are. So there's a relationship there. There's a very interpersonal relationship. So I will swing by and just see your kid on my way home. I will, you know, it is important that we put our hands on you. So Blueberry Pediatrics is definitely fitting a role where I believe they're thriving. I hope they're thriving, because they're providing something that, you know what, the status quo is not providing. So yeah, good job, Blueberry Pediatrics. I like to view them as a collaborator, because they're normalizing a market for us. But again, it's not like a specific doctor there. And so I think for us, the gadgets, the doohickeys, other things, that's not a worry for us. Something that I see coming up is something about like AI. Oh, AI is going to replace the doctor. No, they're not going to replace me. It's not. ChatGPT is not going to replace me, because there is something that robots just can't do, and that's be human. Absolutely. The human touch is just not there. I'm not worried about AI. Actually, if AI is there, like I would, knowing me, I'd figure out a way to utilize it.
Well, you could bring Baymax, like an actual life-size Baymax, into your clinic, and I'm sure you'd get more patients just because they'd walk in the door to pick
up. That would be awesome.
Baymax, yeah. I would be there. Like I would totally fly to do that.
Yeah. But there is something about an actual human. And those human experiences, there's a reason why we slaved ourselves through residency. It's those experiences we're bringing.
And like when you talk about humanism, I mean, look at what we're doing. Like we're listening to your story, and that's what's making an impact in people who are listening. It's not like, oh, there's a picture of Dr. Gupta, he's so handsome, but like, no, he has a story behind like all the handsomeness. So, you know, I think that.
Thank you.
I think that that is something that people need to hear, because it is a big thing that people are talking about right now. Like, oh, are we going to be replaced by the speed and the exactness that an AI might have compared to the human brain? And while
a traditional fee-for-service physician is being replaced as we speak, not from AI, but by the systems they work for already.
Absolutely. That one hits to my heart, because my husband just got replaced by a non-physician model at the clinic that he was working at. So amen to that statement. This is where, you know, it is so heartbreaking for people to go to medical school, to go to residency, and to not be prepared with the fact that like no physician job is guaranteed. I mean, yes, like we are business owners and we take a risk in DPC, but when you expect that your, you know, golden handcuffs, employed role is guaranteed to last forever.
That's gone.
Yep.
Even if you're a partner somewhere, you think you got a cash cow, you got an income. No, your insurance reimbursements may drop and you may get bought out. The other partners in your group might be like, hey, let's sell ourselves to Cigna. And that might happen. And actually it does happen. And you will be replaced. That's where we're going. So I'm not even worried about robots or ChatGPT or AI. It's happening right now. You're being replaced, or you're being made redundant. Do more with less, right? It's all comes down to the lean operations. That is not a new concept. That is a concept that kind of makes capitalism work. Now, whether you morally agree with it in medicine, nobody gives a shit. So now for something like Rivertown's Peds, where I'm directly paid by the patients, we're thriving, we're growing. It's a slow growth, but it's fine. It's happening. It's growing. Now, right now, the economy is, looks like it's taking a downturn. I have some families who aren't able to pay me anymore, or that not able to pay the regular rates, their current rates. You know, when I started this, there was a couple purposes. I wanted to make more money. I wanted to be able to provide the kind of care that I wanted to be able to provide the care that, like, I'm smart. Like, I want to make sure I provide the best kind of care I possibly can. I wanted to change my lifestyle. Well, one thing about being an entrepreneur is your lifestyle sucks. So, but also I wanted to send a message that this is going to be possible. And this is going to be this is going to be resistant to the whims of the economy. So we are going to we're starting to see a slight flattening of growth right now. But a slight flattening of growth is better than going backwards. So I'm not letting those patients go because they can't afford to pay me. I'm saying, look, I've been your pediatrician for years. Like, we got a relationship. I'm not going anywhere. And you're not going anywhere either. You know, the amount of time, the relationship we have, look, I'll stop their payments. I'll stop the charges. And I know that when they're back on their feet, they'll pay me again. It's fine. I'm fortunate I'm in that situation now. 25% of our patients are on Medicaid or uninsured. I'm going to say we are going to be recession proof because, hey, when people lose their jobs, we're cheaper than COBRA. If they lose their COBRA and they're completely uninsured, we're cheaper than going anywhere else. So, you know, your kids are going to be vaccinated. Kids are going to get the care when you need it.
It's crazy. You know, I think about coming up next month, there are, I think the number that I was told was like 116 kids who can't matriculate into seventh grade because they don't have their Tdap vaccine. And the public health department is needing someone to vaccinate and they don't have anyone. So I'm like, I'll do it. My husband will do it also because he is currently, joining my DPC, but we have the time to do these things. And so it was like, great. We have now people to vaccinate, but then, the uninsured or the people who have VFC can get the vaccines from public health, but then we can't get the vaccines for the other kids because they're insured. And so, they can't get in to see their provider, physician or non-physician provider before school starts. So, then how about we run their vaccines through their insurance at the local pharmacy and pick it up in a vaccine fridge and vaccinate these kids? There's 116 kids who can go to school. It's like, the idea that, again, it's like this health insurance is not healthcare. I mean, look at if you're 25% of your kids have Medicaid, I can just imagine the number of clinics that are excited to take that reimbursement for each visit that they have. And, their accessibility, as I'm assuming like the Medi-Cal patients are, goes down because they have Medicaid or Medi-Cal. And so when it comes to that part of, being a disruptor and accessible care, that in some families' minds is the number one thing. Like, you're talking about parents want a doctor that they can actually talk to when they need to. And that's what you're bringing. So
those Medicaid patients, they can't afford to go to a Medicaid doctor because they're working jobs. They need to be able to take their kid to a doctor that can see them or have their babysitter take their kid to the doctor. We don't realize that insurance does not mean healthcare.
It's like, if there's one lesson that you've learned from this episode, like that is a huge one right there. When you guys, I don't think you're giving yourself all the credit that you guys deserve, because when you talk about recession proof and when you talk about growing slowly, like I want to really highlight that you guys are not going into the red and you're growing with multiple doctors and now, multiple locations. So a couple of things, like I noticed on your logo, there's a trademark, which I think is flipping awesome, because somebody asked me like, why is my DPC story trademarked? I'm like, because I worked my butt off to create this thing. Like, I'm proud of it.
All of our logos are trademarked. You just can't take it.
Can you speak to that? But then also, can you speak to how your Rivertown's Dobbs Ferry, and then we have now Rivertown's Staten Island?
So the branding, the logo, worked hard on it. I wanted a bat symbol. I wanted that logo to be visible, recognizable. But the, so therefore those were trademarked. But there's two parts to that. You know, it is balancing out the logo and the doctor. For me, they're not the same. And actually, if you look at your Google, like when I, every month I get these Google kind of reports. So it's like 50-50. People are Googling Rivertown's Pediatrics, which I will say was, is a logo. And then they're Googling the individual doctors. We're not one in the same, but we're under the kind of same, the same symbol, the same logo. And I don't know, like, I just didn't want somebody taking my logo.
I totally get that. And like, yeah, like when I relate to that, you know, my history, what I was exposed to was my dad created a logo for Eskrima. That's a martial art of the Philippines. And everybody has used this triangle and the, there's a knife and a stick, and it's like, he never trademarked it. And so now, you know, everybody's using that idea and my dad created it, but it's like, he had no protection. No. So, you know, I think that it's like, how you were exposed to compassion in when you were in medical school and rotating, that was how I was, you know, exposed to like what happens when you don't protect what you have created. So I think it's super important for people to hear, especially as, you know, the movement grows, like consider getting your stuff trademarked, because, you know, it's literally a way of future, of helping your future self. I feel
it's on stickers, you know, and I sometimes see that out, like on social media, somebody took a picture of their kid and they, you know, my logo's right there. it's kind of cool. And Staten Island has its own logo. Every borough we've been, kind of, brainstorming like what logo for every borough of Manhattan, if we ever create another office in a different borough. For us in Westchester, our logo highlights the Tappan Zee Bridge. And so that is something like the bridge is, I mean, the river towns, the bridge is right here in our river towns. It's something very it's recognizable for us. So for Staten Island, if anybody's ever taken the Staten Island Ferry, you know, you pass by the Statue of Liberty. So the logo contains the Statue of Liberty. For Staten Island. We're trying to figure out, you know, we got ideas for Brooklyn. We got ideas for Manhattan, trying to figure out Bronx. Maybe we just won't open up an office in Bronx. They were like, well, can we do pinstripes? I was like, no, the Yankees might get upset. We're still figuring out the Bronx. But you know what? Maybe we'll, I'm satisfied not even opening up an office down there. I don't know. But we are growing. We're growing slowly. We're growing well. You know, there were times in the beginning where, especially in the first year, you know, I asked my accountant, I was like, oh man, did I make a mistake? I'm not growing that much. I'm not making that any money. And he's like, give it time. I was like, should I take insurance? He's like, no, because my accountant has a lot of fee-for-service doctors in his practice. And he's like, and he's provided me so much reassurance over the years. Like, look, they're failing. You have the right business model, you know, just be patient. It will come. So I think a question I get asked a lot is like, how long did it take me for me to become, to start paying myself? So first of all, my expenses have been paid starting after year one. For me to break even year one. I started paying myself after year two. Now I'm not paying myself again. I'm taking more expenses out. I'm expensing a lot more, but I just hired a new pediatrician. I have other business ventures that I'm doing. So I'm pouring a lot more money back in. I am on payroll. So I am getting something, but I'm starting to look forward to the next pediatrician I'm going to hire. So I'm saving that up. So if I do pay my, you know, whatever I'm paying myself, it's really with the mindset of like, I'm probably going to have to use this again to pay another pediatrician soon. Probably in 2024, 2025. So I'm looking for the next one.
They might be listening to this podcast. So that's awesome. When you talk about how hiring Dr. Gallagher recently, and then Dr. Brayev, and then also Dr. Solomon, I want to ask.
So Brayev and Solomon are, mm-hmm. they're independent. So Gallagher is a true employee. Dr. Beriev is, he licensed the brand. And so with brand licensing is basically he pays me an annual fee. You know, I set up his back office structure and then, you know, whatever he's making. Dr. Solomon, she's a co-brand. So she started up she was the first family practice DPC in Westchester. And then she was struggling financially. It just wasn't taken off. I was taken off and I was like, I think 6 months in, I kind of was, we had a kind of like regular kind of meetings just to see how it was just us. Like I approached her initially to be like, hey, I'm starting up my own practice. I don't want to be viewed as a competitor, just as a collaborator. So we had regular kind of check-ins and, you know, after 6 months of me being, after I started, I said, hey, how are you doing? She's like, not good. I think I'm going to close. I was like, don't close, maybe close this office, but come to my office. I have an extra room. I have a lot of the parents want, what their kids are getting from me. So she's a co-brand. So I didn't hire her. She basically, and then once she joined, we both elevated both of the practices.
I don't know if it was at the PEDS DPC Mastermind or if it was somewhere else, but somebody was talking about how, like, when you go get gas, you know, you go off the freeway and it's like there's a Shell and a Chevron.
That was that me.
You? Yeah,
that was
absolutely genius. Like, for people to really understand, it's not competition but collaboration, and it increases awareness in the market. Like, that was I mean it literally stuck out in my mind, because it's like, you know, when a DPC opens, it means that there is a ton of people who are looking for that care that another DPC needs to open.
Yeah.
Not that, like, oh, they're all going to jump ship and then go, because remember, they're buying into you as the doctor and not, you know, oh, DPC.
They're not, they're not buying into DPC. They're buying into that doctor. And that's key. So if we're not competition, we're collaboration. Another pediatrician can open up across the street from me. I'm not going to care. I'm kind of at my own capacity anyways. Like, cool. I mean, I don't know why you didn't just join me, but okay, fine. If you want to do things the hard way, you can, I think it's also important. A question I'm always asked is like, but with your model, how do we take care of everyone? I'm going to be blunt. I'm not taking care of everyone. I'm not. And do I care? Yeah, I care about the patients who are my patients. But, you know, like, us trying to take care of everyone, well, how's that going? Because we're not doing it. Like, we're focused too much on the payment side and we're not taking care of everyone. The kids are left behind. They really are. Just in your town alone, 119 kids need a TDAP and half of them are insured. Well, how's that working out?
Well, yeah. And I mean, when we talk about equity, like, you know, I think about how there's a family medicine doctor in the Santa Cruz area who has over 4,000 patients. And it's like, great, you have a doctor, but what kind of care is that? And how are you, you know, how easy is it to get in to see that doctor? It's so interesting to hear people talk about their healthcare and they don't see the value proposition sometimes of DPC, because they're so exasperated with the system as patients, you know? So no matter what insurance they have, they could have double, you know, Medicare. Yeah.
So I rarely ever talk about the finances. I rarely do, just because, like, the American public can't do math. We know that. We're famous for being poor at math. So I don't even talk about it. Because also, I don't talk about it because that's just not my brand. My brand is not there to save you money on your insurance. You will. Like, we're priced well below the average family deductible of New York. You're going to save money with us. I just don't tell you that because I don't want to talk about it, because you're not going to get it. Most people don't get finances. So why even talk about it? What we should talk about is the care, and the care that, like, you know what? Your kid fell and needs stitches on a Sunday afternoon. Cool. I can meet you in the office in 15 minutes. Done. And, you know, that's that's it. Oh, and by the way, I just saved you $1,200 on an ER visit. I never say that because I don't need to.
Well, that's not what's going to be shared on Facebook. Like, oh no, Dr. Gupta just saw my kid in 15 minutes. Like, yeah, don't you have that? Oh, I do. All of our kids do, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this Sunday, this Sunday, I rented out the movie theater for Super Mario Brothers. So I'm going to take a selfie with 100 kids in my practice. it's going to be great. That's another thing. It's like, hey, yeah, it's fun. We're all going to hang out.
I love that. Let me ask you this, because as you know, there might be, again, your future DPC pediatrician partner who's going to open the Brooklyn office and then help figure out the logo. When people hear about, you know, this awesomeness of like not only the patients getting access when they need it, but also that you're like you talked about, like you're able to keep up your skills, you're able to do the things that you want to do as a physician and bring all of your nerdiness and all of your education and technical skills to being able to treat every single patient of yours. That is so attractive to medical students and residents. Like, hands down, when they hear what we're actually doing as doctors, they flip out. Like, they're like, you know, they, and this has happened for years, and I love that the trend is growing, but like, they migrate. Like, everybody wants to hear the one doctor talking about DPC. And as we're in this space of more and more people are getting educated about it, they're being, they're aware of it, and this movement continues to grow. What would you say to people who are thinking about DPC, who are also thinking about, could I, to pay off my loans, do an employed position? Because when it comes to New York and non-competes, that's a thing, versus in California where it's not. So how would you advise people who are thinking about DPC to think about their contracts and choose them carefully and wisely as they're planning DPC in the future?
So universally, doesn't matter if you're New York or California, do not sign a non-compete. Like, just don't. I mean, just physicians across the board nationwide have to stop signing non-competes. They're obsolete. You're obsolete. They've replaced you. They are easy to replace you. So why are you giving them the power to not let you work in your state again? Don't sign a non-compete. It's just ridiculous. And can you do an employed position and start up a practice at the same time? Is that your question? So for me, I needed, because I'm starting, this is a brand new market, right? I went 100% all in. You know, I didn't sit by on my butt, like waiting for the phone to ring. No, I was out there just pounding the pavement. As I'm pounding pavement, I have Lauren, Dawn Creative Group, you know, she's doing the social media marketing. You know, I'm pounding the pavement, shaking hands, kissing babies. Basically, I was running for like the mayor. And that was it, just getting the visibility out there. If I were trying to do this on the side, as you know, if I was doing my DPC as my moonlighting job, I don't think I would be where I am right now. I had to 100% commit to this. Now, is it doable? I think so. But I think really you have to be honest. Like, is your market ready for your practice? If your market is ready, if there's a couple of other practices in the area that are already doing it, then your market's ready. Then you could probably moonlight and like build. But if you're creating a brand new industry, you kind of have to go all in on it. That's why, like, I don't know, like, you really do need to have that budget. You need to have a nest egg really set up if you're going to go this route. I think marketing DPC pediatrics is going to be much more of a challenge, because, you know, one of the first questions you might get is like, oh, but I already have insurance, you know, and that's one of the things. It's like, well, you're not competing with their insurance. You're never competing with free, right? That's something you never compete with. You never compete with free. You compete on the product. You tell them what the product is all about. That's going to take time. And as a pediatrician, you have to tell these families what it is that you offer and what you're going to dedicate to those, their kids. So I think it may be a bit more challenging to do it if you have a full-time job to start your own practice. So totally, I don't know. I mean, is it done? I'm sure it's being done. I couldn't have done that.
What about your thoughts on how to incorporate DPC peds into employer health plans?
Yeah, I don't know. I tried and failed, because like, it just made zero sense, right? Child labor is not a thing in this country. So it just was not going to happen. Now, I do have a few employers who have paid for the memberships, only a few. But the thing is, look, a kid is going to be at least an 18-year commitment. People change jobs all the time, especially if you're in the tech industry, right? I think if you're trying to bank on employer paid memberships, you're going to have to deal with a lot of swings in your own financial stability because jobs change a lot. People keep moving on. So I don't think it's a market for peds. I don't think it's there. And I think it's too complex. In a state like New York, where everybody also has insurance, I just don't know where it's fitting. You know, I don't know where that role is. So I wouldn't get too hung up on that. And that's my advice. Don't even bother with that part. Get hung up on how you're going to provide the best care possible for your kid.
I love that. So let me ask you in closing, Do you have any other advice for people who are considering doing DPC in the pediatric space?
I think if you're going to go into the pediatric space, have patience. Have a thick skin and fully know yourself and why you're doing this. Know your why. What is your why? And know it, commit to it. And you really got to believe in yourself because, God, your family is not going to believe in you. My wife did, thankfully. But the rest of my family kind of questioned it. My neighbors definitely doubted it. My community definitely in the beginning doubted it. I mean, some people even called me evil for not taking insurance. But I think, you know, it was the passion of pediatrics, of being a member of this community, that really showed. And that's why we're thriving now. But it took a lot of effort, a lot of effort.
And it's been well worth it. Look at the impact that you're making. So thank you so much, Dr. Gupta, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here. And I'm glad I finally get to sit and chat with you.
Next week, look forward to hearing from another amazing DPC physician. Now, I looked through the stats for the podcast since it started, and the data is beyond incredible. My DPC story is ranked in the top 0.15% of all podcasts on the globe. Yes, the globe. Every single month over the last two seasons, we are ranking in the top 250 of the Apple Podcast Medicine chart every month as well. If you would like to join us in helping spread the word about DPC, consider sponsoring the work we're doing. Go to the sponsorship tab at mydpcstory.com or check out the link in the show notes. Now to our listeners, thank you so much for helping more and more people find the pod by sharing the word about DPC. To our guests, thank you so much for sharing your stories. If you are looking to be a guest next season, apply on the contact page at mydpcstory.com. There you'll also find DPC swag, past episodes, resources, and more. And as always, if you're looking to read more about DPC on the daily, check out dpcnews.com. Until next week, this is Marielle Conception.